I'm thrilled to be able to introduce to you the team of experts on the stage representing investment professionalism in each of a series of different asset classes, and with Tim's role in particular in the area of asset allocation. Paul Taylor, Head of Australian Equities for Fidelity International. Todd Cantor, MD of LaSalle Investment Management. Scott Berg, Portfolio Manager, International Equities with T. Rowe Price, working as the 2IC to Rob Gensler, who some of you have seen. Dominic McCormick, CIO of Select Asset Management in the hedge fund of funds area. And Tim Farrelly, Principal of Farrelly's. Now, what we don't have in front of us today is a bunch of economists. What we do have is a group of investment professionals with distinct experience and view on the investment markets that they're working in. Some of those views are, as we say, bottom-up perspectives. We have a couple of stock pickers deliberately in this group who are not in the business of saying, long-term, this is what I think, but nonetheless do have a view on what's going on in the markets. Tim, you've been involved with us in the Inquisitor role in past years, and this year you're working with us, if you like, as an implementation specialist. You and I have chatted our way through how to try and make some things a little more practical and tangible for everybody. Give me your reflections on how it is and why it is we can deal in this way.
Yeah. As Graham said, the feedback we've got over the last few years has been, this is a fascinating session, but what does it mean for me? You know, what do I do differently when I go back? And one of the things that we found is you kind of need a framework for putting everything together to try and translate this information you're getting, saying what practical difference does it make? And that's really what we're going to try and take you through today, is a framework for thinking about long-term returns in markets. The key things that will drive markets in the long term, particularly equities and property, is, you know, how fast can they grow their earnings? And what valuation will the market put on it? If you like, you know, where is the share price? It's the price earnings ratio multiplied by earnings per share. How fast are earnings going to grow? What sort of ratio will the market apply? And that's really what we're going to be talking about today. So as the speakers are speaking, try and think to yourself, what does this mean for earnings growth in the long term? What does this mean for valuation ratios? Because what we're going to be coming back and asking you to do is, with the gizmo, what do you think growth rates are likely to be looking like, what are valuations likely to be looking like, and as Graham said, we're going to then take that down on an individual basis and say, implicit in your assumptions is a forecast of X for this market, and what does that mean for different portfolios? And we'll look at this both on a group basis. Bryce yesterday was talking about the wisdom of crowds and, you know, how a large group of experts or people who know roughly what they're talking about can get a much closer bet on the weight of a pig. Well, we're going to see whether this group can get a much closer guess on where should valuation ratios be, how fast can earnings grow. And it'll be very interesting to see what the results come back, both as a group and for all of you individually, where we'll provide the results.
Okay, thank you, Tim. Finally then, how did we pick this group? As I've said, not all of the participants in this panel are top-down, long-term view experts. They may have people in their organisations with views like that, but these people are specifically chosen for their expertise in markets in different ways, shapes and forms. And they are all experts, having, in addition, top-level ratings from at least two of the recognised research houses in the Australian market. And so each of these organisations, we've worked with the research companies and identified them as what we call a portfolio pick. And in the first instance, I'd like to ask Paul Taylor, Head of Australian Equities, to come up to the podium with me. And Paul's going to take a few moments just to give some of his perspectives on the Australian equities market. It may be different by the time you get back home, Paul, to the office, but give me, in perhaps just a 30-second thumbnail, What's the kind of investment style that Fidelity International applies to Australian equities?
Thanks, Graham. Fidelity is a bottom-up stock selection firm. Our philosophy is actually getting out and meeting with companies one-to-one basis. We do that right around the world. So I think Fidelity covers about 95% of the world's market cap. Got a strong team here in Australia and actually have investment offices right around the world. The idea being that, you know, from that bottom-up individual stock perspective, you get a very good view on the quality of the management, the quality of the company, the strategy for the next few years. You can also, we can also link that what's happening in Australia with what's happening around the world. As you can see, that's playing out right at the moment. And we set it up as very much a global research network where our analysts in Australia or anywhere in the world are communicating what's happening in those markets, where valuations are, where fundamentals are, how that can impact other parts of the market. Australian companies, like companies right around the world, are very global, and we think you need to understand not only what's happening in Australia with Australian companies, but also what's happening with Australian companies around the world and what global companies are doing in Australia.
Okay, so take 5 minutes or so, please, Paul, as a thought starter for our discussion. The Australian share market over the longer term, what's your view?
Thank you. Morning, ladies and gentlemen. What I thought I'd do today is just to try to have a look at what we think may happen over the next decade for Australian equities, is to have a look over what's happened over the very long term in Australia historically, what really has been the key drivers for the success of the Australian stock market, and have a look if those key drivers are still going to be in place for the next decade. This particular chart was done by academics at the London Business School. Now, this is really long term. I often use this because people say, well, you know, Australia's been a great market over the last 3 years because of our terms of trade. China, global growth has obviously benefited a lot of the sectors of Australia. But if you look, Australia's been great over 3 years, over medium term, and has actually been spectacular over the long term. This chart was done by academics at the London Business School. What it shows is the real equity market returns since 1900. So the real equity market returns on an annual basis for 106 years. So Australia's not only been great 3 years, midterm, it's been fantastic over 106 years. It tells you that on a real basis, so adjusting for inflation, the Australian stock market has delivered 7.8% per year for 106 years. On a nominal basis, that's about 12%. So 12% per year for 106 years is a great result and puts Australia right at the top end of world standards. So now if we dig into that a little bit deeper and try to understand why Australia is top of the world, what has been the key drivers from that? And this is probably a bit of a mix of what came out of that academic research as well as some of our thoughts as well. The academics that did the research paper actually found there was a few key performance measurements that were consistent across a lot of the countries that were at the top of the table. The first one they found was actually population growth. Those countries that did well typically were New World countries, countries where you had high population growth. Australia over the last 100 years has had about 2% per annum population growth, which is right at the top end of the world tables. Next 10 years is probably about 1.5, which is obviously not as good as the 2, but still very high by world standards. The OECD average population growth is about 0.5%. So Australia is still three times the OECD average. Actually, the one standout on the population is actually India, where they're still getting well above 2. Australia is obviously very much driven by immigration, which is the big part of our population growth. Historically, it's been about half immigration, half natural. Now it's moving more towards immigration. But still a very strong market, still a young, in terms of demographics, still a relatively young country within an industrialised world. The second key factor that the academics found was a key determinant of why certain countries performed strongly was that they were just lucky enough to have a very strong natural resource base. And that's obviously the case for Australia. Not only do we have a very large natural resource base, we also have the investment climate that protects companies when they actually undertake a lot of this, the mining activity. Also, low cost base for mining. So I think there's a statistic that Australia has never ever, the amount of mining activity that's happened in Australia has never actually declined. Because we have the low cost mines. So even as commodity prices go up and down, when you're at the low end of the cost curve, you're continually taking the ore out of the ground. It still is economic for us to do so. So that the low cost structure of our mines is obviously quite important. Good corporate governance, they found, was a very strong factor. One of the things they looked at was the correlation of economic growth to stock market performance, and they actually found there was zero correlation. So it didn't matter what GDP growth was, and they brought that primarily back to, you know, property laws. If you have high GDP growth but you don't have corporate governance, it doesn't necessarily mean that your investors are going to get the returns, that's necessary to make that investment. So corporate governance is very important. Obviously, Australia has had one of the highest corporate governance systems regimes in the world and continues to have a very high corporate governance standard, which also puts us in good stead going forward. Sound companies to invest in, so good local and international companies based here in Australia is a key part of it. This last bit was a really interesting bit. They found that, and this, you know, makes perfect sense on a long-term basis, the best correlation with the long-term equity market returns was dividends. So what they looked at, and I'll take this into the next slide, and this makes perfect sense, because any equity you own, the rent that you achieve from that, the economic rent you achieve from that, is the dividends. So in the long term, basically, your returns from owning equities is the dividends. What they've looked at here is the equity market returns, once again, the real equity market returns, against the dividend yield of that market, plus the real growth in dividends. And you can see that's almost a perfect correlation. So they're saying the very long-term performance of all the different stock markets was the dividend yield of that market plus the real growth in dividends. So in Australia's case, we've had a 4-5% dividend yield market and a 3-4% real growth in dividends, which has almost perfectly matched the real long-term returns of the Australian stock market. Now, once again, if you look forward, Australia's dividend yield is one of the highest in the world, still around that 4.5% level, and our real growth in dividends is still very high by world standards. Once again, continuing to put us at the top end of the world tables. The other interesting part of this is actually bringing it back to corporate governance as well. Because of our tax regimes, the Australian market, we put a lot of pressure on corporates to actually pay out a very high dividend payout ratio, because that is a tax advantage to us. Because of that, creates capital discipline, which obviously enhances the corporate governance system as well. If you try to look for the next 10 years, pretty much all of those five key drivers are still very much in place. High population growth, excellent natural resource base, great corporate governance environment, good local companies, good global companies in Australia, high dividend yield, high real dividend growth. On a valuation basis, the long-term PE of the market is still 14, 15 times, which is in line with its long-term average, and earnings growth of, you know, double-digit earnings growth. So it's still very attractive features. If we look for what possibly could happen over the next decade, our expectations should really come back to what has happened over the last 106 years. That's our best guide. And that tells us that based on those fundamental key drivers of the Australian market, Australian market should deliver around 12% nominal real return in the market, primarily driven by the dividend yield and the high real dividend growth. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. Okay, now I want you to freeze that little neuron in your brain shut with the closing comments that Paul gave you, because we're going to be moving into some discussion a little later when we've worked through each of these little vignettes, looking into each of the investment markets. Our second speaker, come on up, Scott, please. Scott Berg, from where exactly, Scott?
Born and raised in Canberra, college here in Sydney, and actually my folks live in Perth, but I'm over in Baltimore in the States now. All over.
How long have you been in Baltimore?
6 years.
6 years, so that's the reason for that kind of funny thing in the back of your...
Yeah, they don't understand me right if I talk the way I used to.
Okay, and Scott, you work with Rob Gensler, International Equities. Give me a 30-second thumbnail on the investment philosophy of T. Rowe Price in the international equities space and the context of the style that you operate.
Sure. And again, the way we think about it at T. Rowe, you know, I'm on a global equity product. And so here, you know, I'm talking on international equities ex-Australia. But, you know, we are really an all-cap, all-country, just try and find the best 70 names in the world. And we're trying to leverage the entire T. Rowe Price. T. Rowe is a global investment house, all styles, growth, core, value, small, mid, large, all the different markets. And we're just cherry-picking regional funds, sector funds, and the analyst to get those best names together. So it's really a mix of all those things, and it's a best ideas fund I'm working on.
Excellent. Well, look, thanks so much for coming along, and we're pleased to see the Australian export industry working well. So thanks for being with us, Scott.
No, well, thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me. A little bit in contrast to how Paul just approached the Australian one, given the global landscape is just so big and diverse, rather than kind of going into individual markets here, I want to try and give you a framework to think a little bit about, an outlook for expected return in the global equity market overall. And a little bit as the guys leading the session have said, fundamentally the way you get equity returns, you know, you need EPS growth and you need valuation. But I'm going to add one more thing to that. It's really three pieces. You have assets get bigger, and so we can call that revenue growth or asset growth in an asset-based business. A business gets better, i.e. the margins get higher, the free cash flow generation off that revenue growth base gets better, or then you get the valuation. So we're going to look at those three different aspects in thinking about what's a reasonable return outlook long term. And the number I'm going to come up with here at the end of the day is somewhere in the high single, low double digits, I think, is a reasonable medium to long term outlook for a nominal global equity return. And we can be above and below that for certain periods, but that's probably a reasonable expectation. Again, with the proviso, we're bottom up. We don't spend too much time on all this, but that's where we'll come out. So the first piece here, and I'm going to talk you through this slide a little. So this is a snapshot of the world, both equity markets and economies. And so if I start in the left-hand column here, we're talking about share of global market cap. And so this is equity markets. This is the MSCI all-country world. And so this is where public markets are valuing public equities today. And so there you see, I'm going to highlight some certain things here. Emerging markets, roughly 10% of the global equity market today. The second column there in orange is the share of global GDP. Because one of the issues, obviously, is that in less developed markets, a lot of economic assets are not publicly traded and traditionally valuations have not been as high. You get a lot more assets that still reside in the public sector or even ones that have been listed or only partially listed or more owned by wealthy privates. So there, when you actually take a look at the underlying, you know, economic value in the world, emerging markets, as an example, goes from kind of 10% of market cap to 25% order of magnitude economic activity. And the US, by contrast, you know, you've got nearly 50% of global market cap, and we're not much more than 30% of economic activity. Now, you get a lot of global companies based in the US, so they're not all exactly lined up. Then we've got the share of global GDP growth. And so here again, on this emerging market theme, suddenly that 10% market cap, 25% GDP is getting close to 50% of global GDP growth. And so it gives a very different flavor again as we're thinking about things. So let me pause there, go back to our bigger, better valuation, and then we'll address those other columns. So the first one on, you know, fundamentally how much is the global economy growing? And if you see there in that fourth yellow column, currently this year, when you weight it all together, we're at about 4.5% real GDP growth globally. You've got the developed world, and the US numbers there have been adjusted down. These are mid-year numbers, given some of the weakness there. We're a bit under 2. Japan, finally, just above 2. Europe, a little higher in the upper 2s. But then when you weight in that emerging markets, you get to kind of 4.5%. And we think looking forward over the medium term, somewhere in that 4 to 5% real GDP growth for the globe is probably a pretty reasonable expectation. And a lot of that is bolstered on that emerging market line that we are really very constructive and bullish on. We don't think this is a short-term phenomenon. Again, a couple of the folks who've come up on stage, even in those little pictures, talking about the likes of India, we really are seeing broad-based industrialization of these economies in a way that hasn't been seen before. It took the Western world, 150 years to move through that, even if these folks do it in a very compressed cycle. You know, is that 150 years, 30 years? We really think that can continue to drive it. And again, I think it surprises most people that those markets already are driving nearly half of that global growth, and we think that can continue. So we've got 4 to 5% real GDP growth, and then we have the nominal inflation, which I'm going to call, 2.5 to 3.5% around the world. A lot of the more developed economies run lower there, but the less developed ones a little bit higher as they're growing faster. So 4 to 5, plus call it 3, 7 to 8% nominal GDP growth. And so when you take all the companies in the world as a whole, that's kind of the growth of the end market they're serving on a revenue front. That's my starting point. Then we've got to think, though, but what is earnings growth in that environment? And so earnings differ from that GDP growth based on whether these assets are getting better. And the two things I'll highlight that really drive that above and beyond all else is, are margins expanding or contracting? And secondly, the free cash being generated by these businesses, how's that being reinvested and what incremental earnings return do we get from that? So on the margin, and you see here, if we look today, that 4.5% real GDP growth, which is again probably 7.5% nominal, is leading in 07 to about 11.5% earnings growth. And so that 4% delta today is mostly just the free cash flow yield. So companies, if you take a company trading at, I'll even go on the high end, 20 times earnings. So that's a 5% earnings yield. That's coming out as cash and being used, or that dividend yield we saw before of a 4 or 5%, that is adding to your earnings CAGR for a kind of equity return. What we don't have right now is a lot of margin expansion. The globe saw a ton of margin expansion across many businesses, many sectors in 03, 04, 05, coming off the bottom in 01 and 02. And looking forward, my view of this, call it 8 to 12%, global equity return assumes we're not going to get much more margin expansion, that a lot of businesses are closer to an upper end, that there's not a lot more there, but at the same time, I don't think there's a lot of risk that it comes a long way down. That is one of the risk factors, but I'm going to say on balance, we think, the continued technology advances, the continued urbanization of the less developed world, and adding more capital to the undercapitalized labor in those economies can kind of balance the developed world headwinds. So margins flat, but you get your return on the free cash generated, the excess capital, and that gets us to a similar 8 to 12% number. And again, 8 assumes there's actually a little bit of margin headwind offsetting that free cash, and 12 assumes it's neutral. You get a bit more if I'm wrong on that. And so then the final piece, so that's got us bigger, we've talked about better, and then we've got to think a little bit about valuations. And that's always the hardest thing. But here, when I just snapshot of the 07 multiples of different markets right now, and really already at T. Rowe, we look out to 08, 07's half in the rearview mirror. And so if I take this with the recent market activity as well and focused on forward earnings, the global markets are at about 14 times earnings. The two ways that can be viewed, on the one hand, people say, well, markets have been much cheaper at other points in time. And that is true. They've also been a lot more expensive. But if you look at it versus the global bond alternative, the global long bond, somewhere around 5% on a blended basis. And we're talking about the global earnings yield around 7%. And so still, big picture as an asset class, we think on the margin, valuation is probably more likely to help us over the medium term versus hurt. And that could add an extra kicker. But, I'm going to say 8 to 12%. Nominal earnings growth globally, hopefully a little bit of a valuation kicker. And so we feel pretty good that global equities as a whole, a kind of double-digit return order of magnitude is not unreasonable.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Scott. Well, certainly I appreciate the fact, and I'm sure you do too, that these first two presentations have started to try and give us some meat to chew on and think about what these longer-term expectations are for the equities markets. Property. Now, that's a bit of a challenge. Todd Cantor, come on up, please.
Sure.
Now, Todd, do you work in the same building as Scott, or is it the same block? Or?
Yeah, in fact, we have to come to Sydney to meet each other, but we work in the same building. We're in Baltimore on 100 East Pratt Street. I haven't seen him in the elevator well, but now that I know his face, I'm sure I'll see him in the lift in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. So there's a multi-asset class fund coming up, is there?
Well, you know, we'll have a conversation and see. Yeah.
Okay. Give us, if you would, please, Todd, a 30-second, just a quick thumbnail on how it is that LaSalle Investment Management deals to the property space.
Sure. Well, first of all, I am with LaSalle Investment Management. All we do is commercial real estate. We invest in commercial real estate. We're located in all the major commercial real estate markets around the globe. It's really a top-down as well as a bottom-up approach. We're looking at the strength of markets. We're looking at the strength of property sectors. But ultimately, we're using that information in terms of revenue forecasts from a top-down perspective, and we're using it to model companies' cash flow growth on a company-by-company basis around the world. So although we're both top-down and bottom-up, we're very much focused on the bottom-up stock picking. And at the end of the day, when you look at the value that we create, the returns that we're able to generate, it's primarily coming from stock selection.
Okay. So thanks then, Todd. We're really pleased to have two folks, you being one of them, who've come from Baltimore specifically for this presentation. So thanks very much.
Thank you. Before I go forward, I think it's important to look backwards, and we have to look over time at property in the proper context of a mixed asset portfolio. This is a portfolio construction conference, so what I want to do is to talk about historically how real estate has fit into a mixed asset portfolio. What are some of the investment attributes of real estate? This, despite the fact that we are talking about real estate, specifically real estate stocks around the globe, real estate behaves quite differently from bonds and behaves quite differently from traditional equities. And you can quantify those differences, those behavioral characteristics, by looking at a couple of statistics. One is you can look at risk-adjusted returns. And over the past 15, 20 years, the risk-adjusted returns of property have been very strong. They've been about 1.25 versus about 0.7, 0.8 for equities and about 1 for bonds. So they've really performed well on a risk-adjusted returns basis. But then there's another component in terms of trying to figure out how they fit into a mixed asset portfolio, and that's looking at correlation of returns. How do they behave? They are real estate stocks, after all. So do they behave identically to equities, and how do they behave relative to bonds? By looking at the correlations, you're able to identify behavior, and what you see by looking at correlation of returns is that they behave quite differently from bonds. In fact, the correlation of returns long-term over 20 years, and it's pretty much the same over 10 and 15, is about 0.2. If they had a correlation of 1, they would behave exactly the same. But and a correlation of 0 would mean no relationship. But a correlation of about 0.2 means there's not much of a relationship relative to bonds. So then the next question is, what about the major asset class called traditional equities? These are stocks, after all. What you find is that there's only a moderate correlation of about 0.5. So despite the fact that real estate stocks are indeed stocks, they behave differently from traditional stocks. So therefore, as a result of low correlations, there's strong diversification benefits. And as a result of strong risk-adjusted returns historically and the low correlations, they've earned their way into a mixed asset portfolio. This is a slide showing two efficient frontiers over a period of time of 1990 through July of 2007. And the green line shows an optimal portfolio, an efficient portfolio, if you just had global equities and global bonds, and you can see what the return would be for a given level of risk. And then had you added real estate into that mixed asset portfolio, you would see what the returns would have been for the same level of risk. And what this shows is that at all levels of risk and return, adding property, specifically global property securities, to a mixed asset portfolio, a portfolio would have had greater returns for the same level of risk. That's diversification. That's the power of diversification, and that's what property has given to a portfolio historically. So they've certainly earned their way into a mixed asset portfolio. Now, the question becomes from here, if they've earned their way in, will they continue to earn their way in going into the future? And what you have to look at then is those same three factors, risk, returns, and correlations. We don't expect for the risk and the correlations to change all that much. They might a bit, but not materially. At least that's our expectation. But therefore, the other ingredient then being returns. How should one look at long-term returns for real estate? Well, first of all, this is commercial real estate. It's not residential. So despite the fact that you've got the very broad term real estate, there's certainly many shapes and sizes to that. And if you look at commercial real estate, ultimately what drives earnings over the long term is rent. What kind of rents can these properties generate? And ultimately, it's revenue, because revenue comes from not only increasing rents, but also increasing occupancies. If you've got an office building, and if it's fully occupied, you can push rents. If you have a hotel, and all the rooms are full, you can push room rates. So that's ultimately what will drive the earnings. And what you could expect going forward from rents is that it will grow at approximately the rate of inflation. So look at inflation around the globe, and that will give you an indication of what we should be able to see long-term from the revenue side of the coin. But there are a couple of other factors that push the earnings growth above the rate of inflation. One is that these companies are levered. They use gearing, and they're about 40% levered. All right. Two, in addition to growing rents, they also buy and sell and develop. They buy properties, they sell properties, they develop properties. So management is able to add value above and beyond just pushing rents. So overall, if you look at the long term and of real estate, specifically commercial real estate, you should see earnings growth somewhere around 4 to 6%. We should not view these stocks as growth stocks. They've had a great run. They've delivered very strong returns, but I think that it's a misperception, and they don't need to be a growth stock to earn their way into a mixed asset portfolio. So earnings of, say, 4 to 6%, but you also have a dividend yield. The dividend yield is around 4.5%. So put that dividend yield on to the 4 to 6% earnings growth, and you've got a return somewhere between 8 and 10%. That's how you should view property. That's how you should view the outlook for property. A return somewhere between 8 to 10%. It could be higher based on where you are in the real estate cycle, but generally speaking, 8 to 10% with a standard deviation historically of around 12% and correlations relatively low to bonds and even low to traditional equities. So going forward, and I'll show you my last slide, we were asked to put together an outlook. Here's the outlook, and I was asked to do it for Australia, the U.S., as well as global. If you have a current dividend of around 6% in Australia, 4.5% in the U.S., 4% overall, here's the long-term EPS growth that we have, and then the long-term expected return. I would say that, generally speaking, we're comfortable saying this is an asset class that can deliver a return of about 10% per year. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, again, hold that thought, and as well, bear with me a moment, as well, would you now please welcome Dominic McCormick. Dom, thanks for coming along.
Thank you.
There you go, a cheer for the local lad. Dom, you're going to be giving us some long-term outlooks for hedge fund of funds, and perhaps you'd give just a 30-second insight into, I guess in particular, GOTX, because that's what the focus is from the Select Asset Management suite, on the way that they go about managing hedge fund of funds.
Well, Select is a multi-manager with a skew towards alternative assets and strategies. We partner with GOTX in the fund of hedge fund space. They're a major global fund of hedge funds with a focus particularly on sort of more market neutral, very diversified strategies. We use them as the core of the hedge fund exposure in our own diversified multi-manager and alternative portfolios, but they adopt a very sort of disciplined approach to assessing the full spectrum of hedge funds out there, but particularly focusing on those lower risk market neutral ones.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
I've got quite a few slides to get through, so I might have to skip over some of them very quickly. I mean, hedge funds is somewhat more difficult than other asset classes in terms of formulating that sort of return outlook, because it's not really an asset class in itself. It's more a mix of strategies and very esoteric individual manager strategies. But it's probably worth just sort of highlighting a number of sort of myths that I think are out there in relation to fund of hedge funds. You know, I think some people still have a perception that fund of hedge funds are high risk, and therefore that you should expect high returns from them. That blow-ups, you know, mean that you should stay away from hedge funds. That fees are too high to achieve reasonable returns. That you need to understand in detail all the underlying strategies that are going on, and that it's easy to select a portfolio of hedge funds. I think what recent developments should certainly have destroyed that myth. I hope to touch on each of those sort of issues as we go through this presentation. I mean, most fund of hedge funds are low risk, and here I'm talking about the unleveraged, very diversified fund of hedge funds. There are a number of fund of hedge fund type products which I think are probably higher risk, and I'll touch on those as well. But this is independent of the type, the way you measure that risk. Now, we know that volatility returns is not necessarily a great measure of risk. It's particularly not good if you're looking at a single individual hedge fund, but it's probably slightly better when you're looking at a very diversified fund of hedge fund strategy. But in terms of other, you know, measures of risk, drawdowns, historical drawdowns from fund of hedge funds versus other asset classes, they clearly show up as much lower risk. The diversification that you're achieving in across both managers and strategies, and they've shown the ability to add diversification in difficult times. And I'm emphasising here, it's talking about unleveraged fund of hedge funds, we believe can fit very much in the defensive part of the portfolio. So what sort of returns should you expect given that? Well, clearly you want to get more than cash and bonds. You're probably expecting a bit less than equities, and you know, the sort of numbers that have been talked about today, the sort that are, you know, generally forecast out there, probably less than some of the higher risk alternatives that are out there, such as private equity. We believe, you know, a fair expectation is cash plus 2 to 4%, depending on where we are. So now it's sort of roughly 8 to 10% per annum. Have they delivered this? Well, yes, that's the case, and I suppose you can look at it in the context of the broad hedge fund industry as measured by indexes, which admittedly have some flaws, or we've also put up the Godex Market Neutral Unlevered Diversified Fund that's been running since 1999. Have they achieved those sort of returns in over rolling three-year periods? Almost certainly over all those periods. There's no doubt we don't hide from the high fees that come from both the combination of the underlying manager and a fund of hedge funds structure. I mean, it does create a high hurdle for the underlying manager's pre-fees in terms of delivering those sort of returns, cash plus 2 to 4% at the end. But, you know, given the expertise of some of the underlying managers, the niche strategies that they're involved in, you know, the modest use of, the intelligent use of leverage at that level. I mean, is it reasonable to expect them to be returning, you know, 15% plus to deliver those sort of cash plus 2 to 4%? We think it is. You know, there's some very sort of talented hedge fund managers out there. Finding them, avoiding the blow-ups is obviously the key. Can they keep delivering those sort of returns? Well, some strategies are clearly correlated to economic activity. You know, there's more merger arbitrage in good economic times. Some of those might go out of favour, so if we did see an economic slowdown, I think it is essential to avoid or at least minimise major fund blow-ups, which, you know, are a continuing part of the hedge fund industry. But, you know, last year we saw Amaranth, a number of fund of hedge funds, not Godex, but had Amaranth in the portfolios. But because they had it at a very low weighting, it didn't really have much of an impact on overall returns. In fact, the shakeout or closure of some funds that we're probably in the process of seeing now can actually reduce competition and actually improve returns from hedge funds. And these periods of market stress can actually provide the base for better returns going forward. This just shows, well, I suppose it highlights two points. One, that hedge funds tend to do better in those periods of market stress when equity markets have poor returns. But it also highlights after these periods of distress when even hedge funds can have, you know, a couple of bad months, is often the time that they do really well. I mean, if you look at that fourth sort of chart there, August 98 was when long-term capital basically blew up. The return in the following 12 months from a very diversified sort of exposure to hedge fund was 23%, so almost as high as you could ever expect hedge funds to return, came in a period after the biggest hedge fund blow-up we've ever had. This hasn't been quite updated for where we are now, but we are, in the moment, going through a period of distress. Hedge funds likely have a tough month. Is that a sign of potential better returns going forward? I'd like to think so. We believe experienced managers are necessary to access these, and I think what's happening now is highlighting that. I don't think all fund of hedge fund products are going to deliver heavily leveraged. You know, we think that, you know, a conservative base portfolio leveraged 2x can make sense, but 4 and 5x leverage, which we've seen in some products, we're very cautious on. Clearly, there's a lot of investors who shouldn't or won't use fund of hedge funds. Those who believe they can do it themselves don't think there's many. If you're happy with cash returns, then there's no point looking at hedge funds. If you believe your clients can handle 15 to 40% drawdowns, then you probably don't, but I don't think too many clients can. Optimists who, you know, live in a fantasy land that 15 to 20% per annum equity returns are going to continue, but there's no point talking to them. And those who believe in efficient market theory, which I think is a decreasing number, because otherwise there wouldn't be the opportunity for hedge funds. Might just skip this last slide, but it was just an example that even a fund of hedge funds once listed becomes a bit more volatile, but it also can create opportunities because it's an example of inefficiently priced markets. Thanks
okay.
very much.
Thank you, Dom. Okay, so we've covered a set of asset classes. We've left out bonds, Tim, and you're going to be talking about some principles of long-term forecasting now for five.
Yep.
So tell us why we've got that empty chair in the middle.
The bond chair, well, a lot of you already know this. I think you all have already know that. What are bonds going to give us over the next 10 years if the bond rate is 6% at the moment? This is not a trick question. We don't really have need a panel of experts to tell us if you buy a bond at 6% and hold it for 10 years, you will get 6%. So that's the bond forecast. It's not difficult.
Okay, Tim, come along and give us 5 minutes or so on some of the issues of long-term forecasting and perhaps give us an insight into what we're going to do with this stuff.
Yeah, great. Thanks. Firstly, we're going to go to a gizmo question, and what we're going to ask you is which of these portfolios is most like the one that you used. Now, there are five quite different balance type portfolios, They've all been set to have virtually the same volatility. I use the word volatility, not risk. They're not necessarily the same risk, but they are about the same expected volatility. So you can consider them to be of an equivalent volatility. So which one of these five is most like the ones you choose? The traditional is kind of like the average fund manager balance fund in the market. The income seeker, I see a lot of planners who run portfolios that look like this. They don't like international equities because they don't get much income. Love LPTs and property because they've tended to give them a lot. The contrarian is more like a portfolio, the type I would favour at the moment. In other words, it's less money in assets that have done particularly well, a little more in assets that haven't done quite so well recently. The new breed, there's a lot of people who have been out in the market, and Dom would love this, I suspect, who would say, actually, in these kind of markets, what you need is a lot more exposure to market-neutral type funds, call them diversified hedge fund of funds. And as Dominic pointed out, these are genuinely low-risk funds. They are much lower risk than equities, subject to his caveats. And so they sort of take up a position instead of bonds. And then there's the highly patriotic portfolio. We're basically just going for a lot of Australian stuff and not very much stuff from overseas. So there's five different portfolios. If you just take a few seconds on the gizmo to vote for which one is most like the portfolio that you run with.
Okay, voting now. 1 through 5. And remember to keep hold of the gizmo number that you've just pressed.
Interesting. Dom, you've got some work to do? Maybe we'll help today. Okay. This is what we're going to, basically, the framework which we are going to use for trying to get a handle on what we as a group think long-term returns are going to be from the various markets. In the long runs, returns come from your income, the growth in income, and what happens to valuations, as all the speakers have referred to. This couple of slides are going to take you through is kind of how it works in practice. Let's assume you've got a stock, it's earning a dollar per share, it's got a P ratio of 10, that means the share price is 10 bucks. Of the dollar, it pays out half of its earnings as dividends, and so that's 50 cents divided by the $10 gives you 5% dividends. Let's assume over a period of 10 years, the earnings double from $1 to $2. If the P remains the same, your share price is now doubled to $20. The impact of something doubling over a 10-year period, rule of 72, 7% per annum. So in that instance, you've now got a 12% per annum return. If, in addition to the doubling of the earnings, you had the price-earnings ratio also double, your share price is now 40 bucks. That extra doubling is worth another 7% per annum. We add the three together and you get 19% per annum. What this means is, in order to get a reasonable expectation of what share prices might do going ahead, you've just got to say, well, you know, what is the dividend yield today? No forecasting required. You've got to have some sense of how fast earnings are going to grow, if you can get a reasonable forecast for that, and then can you get some sort of reasonable expectation of where price earnings ratios might be down the track. And that's why all of our experts have been talking along that lines. As Dominic says, in the case of diversified hedge fund of funds, really the forecasting comes down to what are you going to get from cash and will we get a little bit better than that, or how much better than that, how much alpha after fees the managers can add. Everyone comfortable with that framework? So all we really have to do to get a sense of where particular equity markets and property markets are going is a sense of how fast can earnings grow and where will these valuations be. One other piece in that is this is equities. We're talking about the price-earnings ratio, price divided by earnings. In the case of property, we mainly think about dividend yields. Dividend yields is dividend divided by price. Certainly in the Australian context, virtually all of earnings get paid out as dividends. So dividend divided by price is the same as earnings divided by price, which is just the inverse of the price-earnings ratio. So yield is the property equivalent of P ratio. So the same formula then applies. So that's what we're going to go through, and I think I'm pretty sure I've got no more slides. Oh, yes. This is the other piece of it. If price-earnings ratios fall, well, that's obviously bad news. And in this instance, price-earnings ratios have fallen from 10 to 5, so $2 by 5, our share price is back to 10 bucks. When something halves over 10 years, that's, if you compound that out, it's minus 7% per annum. And so you add them up and you get 5% per annum, basically your dividends. So this is the process we're going to be going through today. And what we're going to be asking you to do at the end of each of the mini discussions we have is enter into the gizmo what you think, having heard from the experts, is a reasonable forecast for earnings growth and what is a reasonable valuation ratio we may see down the track.
Okay, thank you, Tim. Now, there were a couple of papers that we included as pre-reading, and so if you want to go back and refer to some of the logic around what Tim has just described, those papers were delivered to you. And if you've got any other questions, we've got some additional paperwork we could supply to you if you let us know. So what are we doing now? We're going to spend some time in debating through these different asset classes to take the forecasts that our panelists have identified and tease them out a little bit further so that we've got some specifics and in turn that we give you the ability to give your conclusion as a result of what you're heard, what you've heard. I give a little flag here, and that is that an early juncture after we've finished with Australian equities and international equities, which we'll be dealing with first, Paul Taylor has asked for leave. The desk is running hot with reporting season and other issues, and so we look forward to Fidelity continuing to perform by having their head of equities there. So Paul will be ducking away at about 10:30 or so. So then, here's some background for you. You've heard Paul give a view. Here are some inputs. Australian equities, real earnings per share growth. First of all, the long-term average. Believe it or not, the lucky country, 0.9% per annum. But the last decade, 7.9% per annum. So there's the context. Now, what do you think? And what do you think based on what our experts think? Paul, in addition to the comments that you made in your presentation, what do you think when you look at these numbers, apart from the fact I'm sure that Fidelity will keep performing, what do you think about these numbers and the prospective outlook last decade compared to long-term average and so on?
I guess my presentation was, what I tried to highlight was actually that people are focused on, you know, the last few years, which have obviously been very good for Australia. But my presentation was actually that Australia has been great over the medium term and the longer term. So, I mean, I'd be interested to see where the long-term, what long-term average comes from.
Tim, you've got a comment on that?
Yeah, that's the 100-year data. It's actually the guys out of London Business School. They looked at earnings growth or dividend growth, which is a proxy for earnings growth, over 100 years. And Australia actually does 0.9% better than inflation, which is actually one of the better performances around the world. And you see it very consistently across all countries. They grow just a little bit faster than inflation or a little bit slower than GDP, whichever way you want to look at it.
So in terms of either short-term or long-term, and Australia's been a great market to invest in. The last decade has been quite good. Obviously, the terms of trade, what's basically happening in China and India is having a big impact on Australia and actually driving that. So I think to me, and part of the presentation is that you, in terms of expectations, you do have to come back to that. What we've got, our best data is 106 years, of data. That's what you've got to come back to. So whether you look at it a nominal basis of the long term is 12%, or on a real basis, the long term is 7.8. I guess the only other question is there anything fundamentally changing that would, you know, impact that long-term, you know, better or worse? And that's what I also tried to cut back to, was that, you know, a lot of those key drivers of why Australia had been such a strong performer, I mean, I think are still very much in place for the next decade. So the long-term returns that have been achieved, I think, are, you know, sustainable for the next decade.
Okay. Comment from the other panellist, Dom?
Yeah, well, that last decade, clearly an increasing share of GDP has been going to corporate profits, and that's showing up in that particularly strong return earnings growth over that period. I mean, do you have any comments? I mean, it's not just Australia, but globally, whether that sort of share of profit share could revert to more normal levels, share of GDP of corporate profits.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. That's exactly right. Corporate profitability has been a big part of GDP. The other interesting thing, what's happened, why sort of the stock markets have done so well, is obviously that wage inflation has been kept under control as well, which is the other side of it. And, you know, people put down, well, you know, so why is wage, is this globalization actually the big driver of maintaining that wage inflation at relatively low levels? If people look at, you know, the Phillips curve in terms of unemployment rate and inflation, it's actually come to almost a flat level, which is a really interesting question. I'm not sure what the answer is going forward, whether it stays flat or goes back to its older, you know, the older scenarios. But at the moment, whether it's globalization, whether it's because other people have argued because tax rates have been coming down, that after-tax disposable income has been better, which is actually people have been okay with wages, therefore corporates have picked up a lot more of it. You know, probably globalization and taxes are probably the two strongest arguments I've heard. You know, what can happen to that going forward? I mean, tax rates right around the world have been coming down. They're probably going to come down further. But how long that goes on for, I don't know. And how long does wage inflation remain, contained? How long does globalization, you know, the movement of work around the world, the movement of production around the world, how much can that control? I mean, probably for a little bit longer, but, you know, China's seeing inflation. You are getting inflation in a lot of these markets. China has sort of taken, brought the global inflation down. How much longer can that happen? I don't know, maybe for a little bit longer, but I don't know how much, you know, it's still a question mark over it.
Scott?
Can I just make a comment? So, you know, just to share our view on Australian equities, and I guess where I see that, or that outlook for EPS growth in that global landscape. I think Australia's an interesting one in that it kind of sits between, you know, it's probably going to be better than the developed world because of that exposure to China and India, but it's still obviously not a true emerging market. It's been through that industrialization, and, you know, if anything, I guess I'm a little wary. There are plenty of markets around time. If you were looking at Japan at the end of the 80s and saying, great 10-year returns, great long-run returns, and then, they can be the times you get tougher things. But I guess net-net, what I would say for Australia, the outlook is probably not that different to our view for global earnings growth or global equity returns, with the exception that you probably get quite a bit more volatility. The makeup of the Australian economy being so resources and financials dominated means that when you look at some of the developing parts of the global economy, be it healthcare being more and more important as populations age, be it the technology trends, you know, Australian equities do not give you the kind of exposure to those that you get in some other markets. And so I think you can get a bit more volatility as price volatility there, but probably, again, about that 10%. I'd be a little lower than Paul, but somewhere in that low double digit.
Okay. Tim, what's your observation? I'll put.
My clients hate me for this, but I'm much more bearish than you guys. And this chart, which Dom sort of referred to these numbers, is kind of the heart of it. Basically, if company profits grow faster than GDP, profits as a share of GDP will rise. It's just maths. And what you see in this chart is profits as a share of GDP have been rising strongly in Australia for a long, long time now. And the really big question is, can this go on? If that line goes flat line from here, when you do the maths, it implies about a 4% growth rate maybe 4.5. It turns out that earnings will grow at GDP if it's flat, because that's by definition, if it goes flat. But we're actually forecasting earnings per share. And the number of shares is continually increasing. And that causes earnings per share to grow a little slower. So if that line goes flat, you're basically saying 4% growth. To say you're going to get better than 4% growth, I think you're going to have to say that line is going up. And for example, if that line goes up, at say 2% faster for the next 50 years, we're going to have profits making up about 50 or 60% of GDP. This is not going to happen. Now, it could go up for another 5 or 10 years, for sure. But I think, you know, for mine, it could go up by maybe 1 or 2% faster, but that would be all. Personally, I think it's much more like it's going to come back to more normal levels. Right now, corporate profitabilities are at very high levels, as high as the data I've seen in Australia. What's going to cause it to go back? It's really hard to tell, because when you listen to Paul, it's very convincing. You look at all those factors and you say, well, they're in place and they're likely to stay in place. Profitability should stay there. The one thing it really doesn't take into account that I think is really important is competition will eventually come into play. And when competition comes in, margins get beaten down and you'll start to see this thing come back, I think. And on that basis, if that comes back to sort of that upper level of the band, you can expect growth over the next 10 years to be just 2% per annum, which is way, way lower than anything we've seen for 15 years or so. It's not part of any of our investment lifetimes we've seen anything like that. But that's certainly kind of where I'm coming at. But really, to me, it comes down to 4% growth is basically saying it's a status quo in terms of profits and share of GDP. If you want it to go, if you think that can continue to go up, it's more than that. If you're like me and are terribly pessimistic, it's going to be less than that.
Can I actually add? Yeah, look, I'm
at one point. I think it's a really valid, the corporate profitability is very high. I think it's an extremely valid point. One caveat I'd put on that, I guess, for Australian companies, we still, that is, that those statistics are constrained within Australia, within the sort of country boundaries. If you look at Australian companies listed on the Australian market, about 30 to 40% of their earnings are actually coming from outside Australia. And a lot of the companies that have been successful in that offshore expansion, whether it's a BHP Billiton, a Rio Tinto, a CSL, they've traditionally been very successful in sort of niche businesses. And, you know, that doesn't get captured within those statistics. So, but I mean, you have a similar argument that corporate profitability right around the world is very high. So, probably two sides of it there.
All right, Dom, a quick snatch, and then Todd, I don't know if you have a comment.
No.
You're happy? Okay, real quick, Dom.
Well, another factor that's been a key driver to profits has been increasing leverage particularly at the consumer level over the last few years. And I think what we're seeing now is, an element of deleverage that could continue, and I think that could be a real constraining factor for that profit share going forward. People aren't going to borrow as much. The financial services companies are less likely to make the sort of money that they've been making in the past.
Okay. Very good. Well, you've had the chance to listen, and I think it's just terrific, and really appreciate the fact that you folk have given time to let us have a look into your thinking. Now's your chance for us to look into your thinking, and we'd like you to go to your gizmo, same one as you used before. That's really critical. Same one as you used before with the number you know. Let's get ready to press the button now. We're talking here of
nominal.
Real...
Nominal.
Nominal, sorry?
Nominal.
Nominal. Nominal. Okay, so everybody got that. Do you want me to retake that? Was anybody... Okay, let's scrub that one. Can we cope with scrubbing that, Pete? Okay, we're going to do that again. Sorry. We're talking about nominal returns. Okay, let's vote again now. You weren't confused at all. Okay, there we go. So 4%. There's your pick. I'm not going to ask for the panel to comment. They've given their comments. Okay, that's going to be fed into the analysis we deliver out at lunchtime. Thank you. Oh, you didn't? Okay, I thought it was the same. All right, sorry about that. My first glitch for the day. I'm doing better than yesterday. Okay, let's try again. Nominal returns, how fast can Australian companies grow their earnings? We're voting now. Okay, there we go. It's about the same. Very good. Now let's move along. And this time we're going to have international earnings per share. And so I'll ask Scott you to give us any additional comments. You're welcome to toss the ball to somebody else or ask a question of your fellow panelists, but same kind of discussion. Yeah. What's your view?
No, I would just start out again by saying, I mean, the clear risk, as I mentioned briefly and rose again on the Australian discussion, is this issue of corporate margins over time and, you know, how high they are or not. But, you know, some of the things that impact that and impact it on the Australian side and on the world side too is you've also had certain sectors of recent when that share of corporate profits goes up. Some of that is that the returns of commodities industries, you know, are fundamentally higher right now than they had been for a very, very, very long period of time. And so just if you look at the profit margins on those businesses, you know, you would expect that to go up some when there is a more robust, demand for those. You also still, the labour thing that was brought up in a number of the discussions too, the back and forth there is that we are starting to see some labour inflation. You know, India's definitely seeing it there, upwards of 15% in some of the IT outsourcing areas. China's seeing some. But in China, you've still got a population that is just over 40% urbanised, with nearly 10 million people a year coming to the cities. And basically, in doing so, entering the global workforce at the very lowest rung, where very little capital is applied to that and that can keep it going. So, I still stick by, you know, what I said before, and let's open it up to debate, but just say that is the biggest risk, but there is a balance on both sides of that. And again, we're talking about, a nominal economic growth of a 7 or 8. You have some of that dividend return or free cash return, and that gets you into the double digits, and the question is how far back does that margin thing potentially pull you or not?
Okay, Paul, can I ask if you've got a comment? You've come from an experience with Fidelity internationally. You've got global capability when you're looking at Australian equities. What's your comment?
I mean, that all sounds quite reasonable to me. And looking at the long-term stats, that's probably about right as well. It is, the risks are, you know, obviously, you know, we're feeling it. We're in a rising interest rate environment. Inflation is creeping in, and you know that's negative for equities, and that is the big risk.
Okay.
But you know, on a valuation basis, whether it's global or Australian equities, they're still very attractively valued relative to other asset classes.
Dom, I'll ask you before you say you want to ask a question.
No, I'll keep quiet on this one.
I'll have a go, Dom. I guess my sense on world equities is exactly the same as Aussie equities, for all the same reasons. Profits as a share of GDP are very high. Profitability is very high. Could you turn to the next slide, please? I've got a slide on US GDP growth, I think. Here it is. This one is 10-year rolling US GDP growth and earnings per share growth. The red line, so the first data point you see on the red line is the 10 years ending 1957. So it's 1947 to 57. The US economy grew, and this is nominal, grew at about 6% per annum. The blue line is earnings per share growth. And what you see, for the most part, earnings grow a little bit slower than GDP, which is exactly what the theory suggests should happen. Because if earnings are a constant share of GDP, they'll grow at the same rate. But we're forecasting earnings per share. The number of shares are constantly being increased. So you should expect it to grow a little slower. And we've had this enormous period for the last 20-odd years where earnings have actually grown faster than GDP, which is a very unusual event. And I think a lot of it is a catch-up from that period in the 70s and 80s where earnings grew a lot slower than GDP. Huge battle between labour and capital. Clearly, labour was the winner in the 70s and 80s. More recently, capital's won hands down. And the question again is, can that go on? And how long can it go on for? And do we see that bounce back? So it's a similar type of argument. For mine, as in Australia, I think it will come back. And so I take my sort of 4.5% growth rate in the absence of any bounce back and take it down to about 2.5%. But if you think, well, we'll maintain this level of profitability, we'll maintain this level of share of profits, your number should be about 4.5% or something like that. Bye-bye.
Can I just have one comeback on that one? Again, that is the US GDP one, and I just would point people back to that one slide I put up there that showed right now, when we're talking global GDP, you know, the emerging markets, again, are driving nearly half of that global GDP growth. And so when we're looking at incremental growth going on in the world today, coming from those economies which are have less capital per unit labour than you want to have and are still at subscale in a lot of cases. You haven't had the you know, industry shake out and whatever. I'm definitely more constructive than that when you look at what's driving that growth. And again, the industrialised world took a long time. This could go on for... put a lot more capital per unit labour in China and India, and that will really help profit share there.
Do you think it'll help the developed markets, or you've got to invest in the emerging markets to get that?
I mean, clearly, today, markets are very, very linked, right? And you take a lot of developed world stocks, and they have decent emerging market exposures.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, you know, we're very bullish on emerging market stocks, and we think you want to be there directly as well, based on everything else.
If you're investing in, say you just hadn't got around to doing emerging markets yet, for whatever reason,
yes,
you're going to get a significant benefit from the developed markets flying over.
You're going to get some benefit. It wouldn't be nearly as significant as when we are looking at the total globe and that EM piece that is 25% of GDP, nearly 50% of growth. When you put that in, that really pushes me over the edge. I'd agree with you, I'd be a little less so if it was purely ex-EM world.
Yeah, the thing, I hear those arguments and I think they sound good, and then you look back at the data and you say, I'm a bit of a dinosaur on the whole globalisation thing. For me, you know, like politics, all markets are local. And you look at Japan. Japan, to me, in sort of 89, 90, were probably one of the most corporately outward-looking countries in the world. You know, the Japanese companies were taking over the world. Yet when that Japanese economy went into decline, the share market went into decline. And they really didn't seem to get any benefit from all this external activity they were doing. And I just kind of wonder if the whole developed world's going to be like that. Yes, there'll be some benefit from what's happening elsewhere, but just not nearly as much.
But while that Japanese... I mean... But in that 90s decade where their economy went into decline, there weren't really robust end markets in those other places nearly as much as there are today in terms of that emerging world.
No,
I mean, that was the US there more than.
But there's plenty of Toyotas driving down Pitt Street.
Yeah.
You know, there was lots of developed markets that were doing quite nicely, and it didn't seem to help the Japanese companies.
Yeah, but Tim, Pitt Street is a little smaller than Mumbai's main street. Anyway, let's move on.
We need to be a bicycle manufacturer.
They could both be a pit, but yeah.
The one thing I'm always interested in is actually the corporate governance around a lot of these issues as well, because for exactly that reason. That the interesting thing that came out of that London Business School study to me was they found that is uncorrelated. GDP growth and equity markets are uncorrelated. And they found that because of all this corporate governance. I think it's exactly the point that you're making there, which is the country can be doing well and GDP growth can be high and things can be going, but if the property protection rights, the legal structures, the corporate governance are not in place, you're not going to make money out of the stock market. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily flow that you get high GDP growth, that you will get high equity market returns. It really depends on the corporate governance structure around those markets. I think that's... And sometimes you can get better returns in equity markets from multinationals that do invest in it if there is a strong corporate governance structure around that. And people argue that your best investment in emerging markets is BHP Billiton because that's, you know, you've got a great corporate governance, you've got, you know, they pay out high dividend structure, they're actually, the processes in place are there. It's not always going to be the case, but I actually bring it back to that because I think that's an extremely important part, that GDP and equity market returns don't go hand in hand.
I totally agree with you, but one thing.
No, GDP's lousy,
equity market returns are lousy.
Okay, we've finished the one thing. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're ready to vote, but as we go to vote, I'd like you to thank Paul Taylor, who's going to exit stage your right. So please thank Paul Taylor very much. Thank you, mate. That. Really appreciate it. Thank you. Okay, I've had a question from the floor here. Could we hear from Bryce? Just right at the moment, we don't have the time to hear from Bryce. I'm sorry. That's a good suggestion. But let's go back to the voting that's on your screen in front of you. How fast can global companies grow their earnings? And if you could vote now. Okay, looks remarkably similar to Australian equities and your view there. So let's move now to the next section. Looking at PEs, and regrettably Paul has departed, so he can't argue the end of Australian PE ratios, but what we've got in front of us here is the two rows we've already dealt to, and now we've got Australian PE ratios, US PE ratios. They will have changed a tad in the last night, but let's not worry too much about that. Rather, let's open the question for a bit of debate. And Scott, you're now going back to a global perspective, seeing your Australian colleague is gone.
Yep.
Any quick comments?
Yeah, well, again, the one missing from there, we've got Australian and US. Obviously, if we're talking about a global equity return, we care about that global PE. And I would just point out that it's lower than the US PE when you look at it all there. And then the second thing I'd point out that's tough with PEs when people look at them over time again is you really do have to think about equities versus bonds. It's not just PE in an absolute sense. And times in the past where equity market PEs were very low tend to be when, you know, the fixed income alternative is very, very high. And so if you have interest rates in very high single digits, 10%, people can get that, then you can get, you know, equity markets where you get down to the low double-digit PEs. But when you're in a world, we talked about a 6% bond, depending how you define where the world is getting that liquidity, overall, I may argue it's even lower if you're talking about risk-free ones with Japan still down in the twos, you know, the US under five. That in that context, the PEs we're seeing here seem very reasonable and, if anything, could be a little bit higher, I think. Because a bond, you're talking about a 5 or 6% yield with no growth, and equities, we're talking about a 6 or 7% earnings yield with growth on that. And, you know,
okay.
put it in context.
Tim, have you got any comments?
Dom?
Dom, thank you.
I was just asking Tim sort of how long the data is for the Australian PE series, because I remember when I first came in the industry, you know, about 20 years now, the average was around 11 for Australia. So, I mean, that average has really been kicked up by the last 15 years or so.
Yeah.
Now, admittedly, inflation and bond rates are lower, no doubt, although we are, seeing some sort of modest inflation pressures. And I suppose this widening of credit spreads, which is sort of going back to normal, I mean, I don't think you can just compared to the risk-free rate, it's corporate credit. What it costs people to borrow does matter.
Okay.
On the Australian. So I talked about the global one. The one other one I'd point out on the Australian one to be careful of there when the current of 16 kind of doesn't look that expensive is, again, because materials and financials are the biggest chunk of the Australian index. Okay, and those two groups trade at some of the lowest PEs of all groups. If you actually take Australia kind of industry by industry and look at the PEs there, versus history. I think you'd find they're a little higher than that. It would show up a bit more, but the weighting of some of those sectors toward real growth in low PE areas right now in terms of companies may have affected that a bit. So it feels to me a little more expensive than that.
Okay. All right. Well, that's useful. Tim, there's a slide or two.
This one, which really backs up Scott's point, is PEs have been all over the place for Australia over the last, well, this is since 1961. But when inflation is low, which is typically when bond yields are low, you get high PEs. When inflation's high and bonds are high, you get low PEs. When it's been in this range of sort of 0 to 4% inflation, PEs have almost always been between 14 and 18. Now, almost every one of those data points is in that range, which for me says PEs go from being something that's really hard to predict to actually not that bad, as long as inflation stays in that range, which I suspect it will do. So I come out and say, look, you know, in the long run, 16's about a reasonable number, which is about where we're at right now.
Okay. US, any comment there?
And it's going on to I use US here as a proxy for the rest of the world. I know it's not the rest of the world, but it's where the better data is. And over that same period, you get exactly the same sort of impact. High inflation, low P's, low inflation, high P's, sometimes ridiculously high P's, but clearly higher than Australia. And I think it's all the reasons Scott mentioned. So for mine, P's should be 18, 19, something of that for around the world. So higher than Australia, which does make, on a valuation basis, international equities look cheap right now.
Okay, here you go. Here's your chance. What's a reasonable level for PE ratios, Australia? 12 through 22, 1 through 6. Use the same gizmo. Ready to vote? Now. Interesting. Okay, the next one, global PE ratios. So our next vote completes this part of the picture. And ready to vote now. There we go, global. All right. Well, we're slowly putting the cake together, probably a little too slow for the timetable. But let's press on and now look to LPTs. And we've got the opportunity to have... where are we here? Okay, just bear with me a moment while my screen comes back. Okay, let's give Todd a quick opportunity for comment.
Sure, I'll go back to my comments earlier that you should really look at commercial real estate around the globe as growing earnings at the rate at which they can grow rents and then add some leverage to that, and then also from the standpoint of being able to add value through development or acquisitions and dispositions. So you should look at your inflation rate here and add a bit for those other factors that I was talking about. And I quite frankly think that it's fair to say somewhere around 3 to 4% for earnings growth over the long term in Australia for Australian LPTs is quite reasonable. I don't know if you have a 100-year statistic to show for real estate, because I don't really think there was commercial real estate around 100 years ago, but I would say that probably 3 to 4% is a reasonable level going forward.
So in spite of the fact that the last decade in Australia has been 2%, you're saying 3 to 4?
Yeah.
That's 2% real, so that's totally consistent.
Yeah, 3 to 4 is
okay, sorry, thank you.
Yes.
Yep. All right. Any other comment?
I guess my only comment is that the long run has been exactly, as you say, it should be inflation plus a little bit. For the most part, until the last 10 years, the property companies have done a whole lot worse than that. Now, in the last 10 years, there's been a lot of gearing up, which, or certainly in this market, they've geared up, which has given them a one-off boost. I don't think they can do that again. There's been a lot of acquisitions that's given a one-off boost. I don't think they can do that again. So I guess my gut feel is they're back to the inflation plus the leverage and the development with a little kick in.
I would agree. I don't disagree.
Okay. Let's give you the opportunity then. 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And this is nominal again. So make your vote. You ready? Let's vote. Very good. Thank you. We'll move now on to yields for property. And what we've got in front of us is Australian LPT yields compared to the dividend growth. And Todd, your call again.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me to see these yields. And in fact, here in Australia, we actually think that we tend to look at it in terms of multiples. We tend to think of multiples contracting a bit in Australia, so therefore yields increasing, the inverse of a multiple. If the current is 5.6 and the last decade is 7.1, it's in line with our forecast to say that it's probably going back to somewhat of the last decade, somewhere around a 7 yield in Australia. And in fact, we're forecasting multiple contraction in Australia, or for yields to go up just a bit from current levels. So to my way of thinking, I don't think that a 7 to even 7.5 yield in Australia over the next 10 years is unrealistic.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Tim, nothing to add?
For once, I'm actually more positive on this than you. My sense is that yields have been far too high for far too long in property, and the market has finally woken up that this is actually a good asset. And whereas the averages have been up the rates, I see it's more like 7, not 7.5.
Sure. And quite frankly, when we look at the globe today and where we're overweighted or where we're underweighted, our single largest, and I think it's important to note here for the conference, our single largest underweight is in Australia.
Underweight?
Yes, okay. Underweight in the portfolio.
Yes. Okay. What's your view of reasonable LPT yields? 4 through 9, we didn't go with the half points. So let's take a vote. You ready? Let's vote. All right. Next step is hedge fund of funds. And have a look at these numbers. And Dom, what's your comment?
Well, I suggested, 2 to 4% per annum, was, I mean, they've achieved that, and that was a reasonable expectation going forward. I suppose coming into this sort of more recent period of volatility, I was probably leaning towards the lower end of that perspective. Hedge funds have had a good year, particularly over the last year. I suspect that, the hedge funds held up well in June and July. August is a tough month for markets generally, and hedge funds are participating in that. Who knows what September will be, but I think we'll look back on this as one of those another periods of dislocation and distress. That causes a few hedge funds to go bust, hedge funds as a whole to have, a couple of tough months, but sets a scene for better returns going forward. And so, out of this couple of months, I'd be sort of more looking at the upper end of that range rather than the lower. So closer to cash plus 3 to 4%.
Okay. Yes, please comment, Todd.
The one I would say that I think is a bit different about that asset class, and I think you pointed it out, that it is all about ultimately, exploiting things, and that over time, where some of those other asset classes, we saw recent periods have been better, this one has a short history, and over time, it would just make sense to me that does come down a little bit on the margin. I mean, the sheer amount of capital out there going after all these strategies now is quite astounding. If we look at, graduates coming out of business schools and just the number of people fresh out that are going straight into hedge funds, where I would argue, what is their real edge and advantage in doing that? And there's just more and more people with more and more money going after it. So 4 has been what it's been basically to date, where you've had less people competing and more inefficiency, you know, my bias would be you'd be going four back toward, if the 2 to 4 is the right range, I would think it's maybe going a bit lower.
Yeah, although the longer-term history, it has been above the four level.
Well, it's clearly coming down.
But I think it is periods like this that actually slow that down. You know, funds blow up, funds delever. It actually increases the inefficiencies that create opportunities. But
Tim,
as usual, I'm more bearish than most. For exactly the argument Scott makes, there's so much money going. You know, the idea of hedge funds is there's a bunch of guys in the room who are smarter than everyone else, and I'm not sure if they're making the dummies quite as fast as they're making these smart guys. And so you wonder if there's going to be enough alpha for them to go around. And so I just see this, you know, coming down. When I sort of run my numbers, I had them coming down to 1% above cash over the next sort of 10 years, but higher than that in the next few. I must admit, I am somewhat persuaded by Dominic's arguments that these sorts of dislocations, you know, set up the environment to get better returns. And I'd probably end up going up to the bottom end of your range at 2%, which incidentally is not a bad return, cash plus 2.
And that's the hedge fund industry generally, whereas hopefully, I mean, it's a bit like private equity. You're trying to find fund of hedge funds that can be above average and, you know...
Yep.
Or find fund of hedge funds that can pick the best hedge funds.
Do you know any of those, Dom?
Okay. Let's take your view. This is the last slide in this part of the program. Let's take your view. What sort of alpha will hedge fund of funds produce after fees? Please make your vote. Interesting. All right, there we go. Now, thanks for your contribution to your results. As we've mentioned, we'll be downloading your results. We test ourselves once more with whether we can get all those bits of things that have been flying around in the room down into a computer and do some printouts, do some analysis. So lunchtime, Tim, we're hoping. They'll be up on the boards in the Portfolio Construction Forum area, some outcomes, which we'll then be debating later in the afternoon what that all means. So we've, I think, had, certainly from my point of view, I've had a sense that there's been some good value in and of itself to get the views of some experts, some specific investment professionals in portfolio management in particular asset classes, and I'd like you now give a vote both of thanks to these folk through now clapping your hands, in particular because with no disrespect to Tim and Dom who've come, Tim via Pitt Street in his Toyota, but with no disrespect to Tim and Dom, we've had Todd and Scott come from the same... Why they didn't take a cab to the airport together, I'm not sure. But came from the same building in Baltimore, especially for this session today. We really appreciate that. And, of course, Paul, who was levered out of his chair to come along today. So thank you very much, guys. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.